I was talking about five biological facts of aristasia which are different from deliria and which shape the culture, or which one may say more accurately are created by the same symbolic forces that shape the culture. Firstly, that aristasians live much longer. Secondly, that they heal much better, a severed limb or whatever will grow back over time. Thirdly, that aristasians do not kill their own kind. And fourthly, that childbirth is less frequent. And fifth, that the urge to procreate, the desire which is in Tularia called sex, is not such a great driving force. And we were talking about how those things fit together, because since aristasians are longer lived, heal better, do not kill each other, they do not require to replace their population at anything like the same rate that schizomorphic people do. This is a very, very briefly, in a nutshell, what we have discussed up to now. Ms. Vargas was just asking me whether this differs, the facts we have talked about differ between the East and the West. Now, one of the facts we were talking about was the fact that aristasians get married less than Tularians, because this pattern of life, growing up, getting married, having children, replacing the population, is not so universal. A lot of people do it, of course, or else the population would not be replaced, but a lot of people don't. And we were talking about how they live if they don't. In the East, this has a lot to do with living with one's extended family and joining in its activity, whether that be the craft work of the Meidler, or the governmental work, or the cultural work of the Rahira. What Ms. Vargas asked was, does this vary from East to West? That is to say, the fundamentals of marrying less and living longer. And my answer to that was, it varies a little, but these are pretty much constants in aristasia. So, in the East, people will live a little longer than people in the West, and it is generally held, it is a fact, that people who live the contemplative life, the religious life, will live somewhat longer than people who don't, because they're more in tune with the force of life. And since the East is more spiritually oriented than the West, Eastern people will live a bit longer. They will also live a bit longer because they are under more traditional conditions. As we know, some of the techniques that work in the West don't work in the East. Some of the, what we may very loosely call magic, that works in the East doesn't work in the West. So the East is more in tune with a more traditional way of living, with a more ancient world. And of course, life was longer, even in aristasia, life was longer in ancient times than it is today. As for marriage, yes, again, marriage is a little more common in the West than it is in the East, and partly because the whole social structure of the craft initiations of the extended family is weaker in the West than it is in the East. The West is a little more like a modern society in Tularia. It's not too much like it. To say it is exactly the same would be misleading, but it is more like it. And therefore, these structures that uphold the married life are a little less strong in the West. And in fact, this brings us very neatly onto what we were just about to discuss, because what we were going to talk about was what actually does happen in the West when people don't marry, because they don't so often go into what would in Tularia be called an apprenticeship. They don't take a mistress in a craft or other way. They do sometimes, but they don't do it so often. They are much less likely to go into an order of votaries, a religious order. They are somewhat less likely to live with their extended family. There is more of a tendency to move away from the family in the West. So, when these things happen, or rather don't happen, What do they actually do? How do they live? A number of institutions have developed in the West which take care of this situation. An unmarried Aristesian might get a flat and live on her own, but that is not very common. Aristesians, someone has said that Aristesians are pack animals. They tend to live together and they tend to need an in-group to belong to. In the East, of course, that will normally be furnished by the religious order, by the extended family, by the craft or way that is being followed, by any number of traditional institutions to which a person will belong. In the West, when young people leave home and don't get married, the institutions which have grown up are, first of all, one which to the West is very normal, and that is good, then you can all hear me. So the institutions which come up in the West, the first one which is quite understandable in Telluria is a small hotel or pension where people will live. This gives them a place to live, which is also to a small extent a community. This is something which is not that often done in Telluria these days, but up until less than 100 years ago was very common in Telluria too. The other two things which are much less common are the residential club and what we call the lay college. The residential club is a little like a gentleman's club in London, a little like that. It may be for, I hear, for gentlemaids, it may be for people at a lower level, but it is, in a sense, particularly on the lower levels, an extension of the small hotel or pension, but it will have a purpose. It may be devoted to singing or poetry or archery or perhaps a group of activities, and the people in it will have a common interest in this. They will see themselves as a group. They will sometimes meet other clubs for contests or exchanges of ideas or for exhibitions of work. So the working maid in, say, Chelverton in Quirinal or Ladyton may well belong to one of these clubs. She goes to work during the day. She will come back to her club. She will dine at her club if she's not dining out somewhere else. She will talk to her fellow club members who she will know very well and who will be her other in-group. One of her in-groups will be her work. The other will be her club. So that is one of the kinds of group. The other, which has even less of any sort of parallel in the West, is the lay college. A lay college is it's like a college in a university such as Milchford. In Aristasia, going to university is very much an elite thing. We don't have this widely democratized university. Only a small percentage of the population will go to an actual university, because universities are not intended for vocational training. This idea of education for vocational training is not an Aristasian idea on the whole. Rather, we have the notion of Raihirlan education. That is what in Telluria used to be called a liberal education, an education to become a cultivated person. Now, the lay college performs this function for people, some people who have not gone to university. The lower, the working maids, lay college will perform that function. Also for, at a much higher level, some lay colleges are for people who have already been to university and who have moved on to a lay college to live, because they are living places. That is what they primarily are. Some of them have a relatively demanding course of study, but some of them have a very undemanding course of study because they are primarily places to live. So, for example, there is a college at Gensalai, which is quite famous, very famous, in fact. Its requirements, it has lectures, it has various activities, but it only requires of its of its scholars one piece of work in a year, one essay or one major poem. They may do more. They may have a raya within the college who teaches her like a personal tutor, but also they may not. So within such a college, living, it is a place to live, it is a place to learn, but learning is often by conversation at dinner, by all sorts of activities that happen. And in Gensalai, where only one piece of work a year is demanded, this piece of work is often of an extraordinarily high standard. Many of the famous works of literature in Aristasia have actually come out of Gensalai College as this one piece of work which is produced for the year. Poets who live at Gensalai might present their best poem of that year for their one piece of work. Ladies of leisure who actually don't produce a lot have to produce that one piece of work, and they want it to be good because the standard at Gensalai is very, very high indeed. Another well-known lay college is the very prestigious Queen Mayana House, which is in Trent near the Novaria border, and that is again a very well-known college of which some of the work is known throughout Aristasia, poems which everybody would know, which are produced there as part of the very minimal work demanded of the scholars. If you remember, part of the reason of this course of study is so that people who wish to write about Aristasia will know enough about the life of Aristasia to be able to do so. So I am talking a little about these lay colleges and clubs so that you will know where and how an unmarried Aristasian will tend to live. She may well be in a lay college. And as I said, one of our friends in this district is going to write us a little story about a maid living in one of the very famous lay colleges in Aristasia and some of the things that happened to her. Emma asks whether Western women actually marry and leave the home environment more. I should just make a point here. Aristasians are not, in fact, women. Women are, in Aristasia Pura, women are one of a division of two sexes, which includes women and men. Aristasians are Jelani and Melini, blondes and brunettes, neither of which are actually women, although they very much resemble women. Do they marry and leave the home environment more? Yes. Yes, they do. Not a huge amount more, but distinctly more. There is a higher birth rate in the West. There is more marriage, there is more procreation. That is one of the notable features of the West. Miss Vargas is acting as our monitress for the day in the absence of Miss Drusilla. Could you please record a large M for Miss Ava? That is a merit. I award merits for people who participate in the discussion. All right, has anyone else any questions on this before we move on? I've talked fairly briefly about this because we are, as I say, going to have a piece of fiction fairly soon, I hope. Some of our girls aren't always as quick as all that. They have probably quite a lot of things to do. But something which would give you much more of a flavour of the actual way of life of one of the Aristasian lay colleges. Miss Poppy, what was your question? Yes, Miss Poppy is going to ask us about Aristasian marriages. Thank you, Miss Poppy. Miss Poppy asks whether arranged marriages, when important families are being joined, whether marriages are arranged and whether parents or relatives are involved in forming alliances by marriage. Now, actually, yes, this is a subject which came up last week. But you weren't here, Miss Poppy, and in fact, most of you weren't here last week. The answer to that is yes. There are a lot of arranged marriages, particularly in the East. They are less common in the West, but they do happen, especially among the higher echelons of society, where, as Miss Poppy says, two important families are being joined. And One of the things that we have to bear in mind here is that marriage is not the only emotional outlet for people in aresthesia. There are many bonds, many close friendships in aresthesia, which would be described as love. The word love has become increasingly exclusive in Western Telluria, so that when we speak of love, some people think this is only really appropriate for a wife or children. But in aresthesia, one may love many different people. So, and this is one reason why the arranged marriage is not, this is a thing which in Telluria is considered very worrying somehow. In aresthesia, the arrangement of marriage is not done without feeling. Two people who are completely unsuitable to each other will not be wedded merely for political reasons, and I use political in the aresthesian sense here of the governing of the realm, the harmony of life. That will not happen, but the fact that maybe they are not in love in the traditional romantic sense doesn't mean that they won't have a very successful and happy life together. And in some cases, their main emotional attachments may be outside that marriage. And that would be perfectly normal and perfectly all right. In other cases, in very many other cases, they will in fact be very, very close to each other and very much in love. Because there is a tamé in all this. One is not married to someone by accident. One of the reasons I think arranged marriages have come to have such a bad name in Telluria is that as we move away from tradition, the principle of werda, the principle of one's being united to the person who is the rightful one because that is one's fate, just like the principle of heredity, these two things wear down, so that whether it is a question of one's marriage being arranged or whether it is a question of one's calling in life being hereditary, this becomes much weaker in the modern West, either in Telluria or in aresthesia. So these things do weaken in the West. But yes, the arranged marriage is a very important factor of life in aresthesia, most particularly in the East. Miss Vargas, can you give Miss Poppy a large M, and could you please now ask your own question? Miss Vargas asks whether brunettes can have children or only blondes. Now, it has, on the whole, been my policy not to discuss the facts of life in the in the most direct sense in which it is used in Telluria. Usually it is blondes who have children, but it is not impossible for brunettes to have children. And I will let you into a little secret here. Children are not born quite the same way in aresthesia as they are born in Telluria. It is in fact a very, very different kind of process. Maybe we'll talk a little more about this later, but I think this is a subject that we should not approach too lightly. But yes, most of the time it is blondes who have children, but it is not entirely impossible for brunettes to have children. Good. Now have we... please award yourself another large M, Miss Vargas. And have we any other questions before we proceed? We've actually taken quite a long time over this, which is really tying up loose ends from last week. Now, the majority of you here were not present last week. So we could, if you wish, go over some of the material we discussed last week rather than proceeding to this week's material. Could you please each indicate whether that is what you would like to do? Need that. Miss Signorina del Giglio was not here last week. Chris Simus couldn't hear last week. Miss Ava was not here last week. Miss Poppy was not here last week. Madonna was, Miss Vargas was, and Miss Carroll, you've been here, but we haven't heard very much from you. Would you find it helpful or not, do you think, to go over last week's material? Miss Naomi, who has just joined us, also was not here last week. Very well. All right. We'll go over it. Well, the point about the other subject, Miss Chrysothemis, is that although it is a rather different subject, I did... what I will do is, I will briefly... I have already briefly recapped what we said last week. So I shall just continue with that brief recap so that the rest of you are up to scratch. Actually, we have gone in a fairly light way over most of it already. We spoke of those five facts of life in aresthesia, which are different from the equivalents in deliria, and we have talked about the ways these have repercussions on the culture. The other thing we talked about last week really was really a little more about those cultural repercussions. We talked about how Dr. Freud brought forward the idea of the procreative urge as being the primary urge, that the urge which underlies human desire. And we spoke about how that is the logical corollary of the vulgar Darwinism that underlies the modern Tellurian explanation of being. If human beings are not spiritual creatures, if they are merely animals who are evolved and whose main purpose is simply the survival of the species, then it would be natural to assume, or in fact it would be necessary to assume, that their higher aspirations, their higher emotions, have no basis in reality. They are simply the what Freud called the sublimation of the animal instincts. Now, of course, in deliria, this procreative urge is much stronger. So in a sense, the masculine orientation of that society, the much higher percentage of psyche, of this competitive, combative urge, which has a lot to do with the what is called the sex drive, is much stronger in deliria, not just for biological, but for symbolic or metaphysical reasons. Aristasians who have some contact with delirians find their preoccupation with their own bodily functions and reproductive mechanisms rather puzzling. They say, surely the novelty must have worn off by now. Why does it continue to fascinate them? And indeed, this appears to indicate a sort of village idiot simplicity, which might be somewhat engaging if it weren't quite so disgusting. So, while late Telluria regards the prototype of all desire as the desire for animal survival, and even beyond the individual survival, the urge to procreate the species, which is the sex urge, Aristasians hold the prototype of all love to be Dea herself, who is pure love, and the prototype of all desire to be the inherent desire of the soul to return to her true spiritual home, because the return of the soul to the spiritual home is the true consummation. Thus, the Aristasian understanding of love and desire is closer to the Platonic than to the Freudian. As Plato sees human love as a step towards divine love, as a spark of divine love which has broken from the divine and will be rejoined to the divine. And from that we need to understand also that Aristasians, when they look at other Aristasians, when blondes look at brunettes, when brunettes look at blondes, when blondes look at blondes whom they admire or love, when brunettes look at brunettes whom they admire or love, they are seeing not just another animal that can be reduced to its bodily functions, they are seeing something spiritual and beautiful which has endless possibilities for romance of many different kinds. One may still sense a trace of this sensibility in later years of deliria, in the work of the Pre-Raphaelite painters or the Romantic poets of the 19th century. It was really in the 20th century, with the acceptance of the Darwinist theory of the human being as merely an animal, and the Freudian theory of sexuality as the real underlying basis of human emotion, that the prison gates of the two-dimensional animal existence closed in upon the human mind. So, whenever we think about Aristaceans, we have to think about creatures who are intensely romantic, who are looking at each other as spiritual beings, yes, but not merely in a religious sense, in a much wider sense, as beings who are beautiful and endowed with all kinds of richness and depth and possibility. And this really is probably the most important difference between the culture of Aristasia and the culture of the 20th century Telluria. And having said that, I think we have rather gallopingly brought ourselves up to date with what we discussed last week. I am going to publish this as an essay in a little while, so you'll be able to read over it in a little more detail. But I think we are now able to proceed to the other subject in which Miss Chrysothemis is interested. I am sorry. My sound became disconnected. I'm sorry. I was speaking, but my sound got disconnected. I'm very sorry about that. All right. I'll just say what I said before once again. Our subject is rudeness and formality in Aristasia. And when we say rudeness, we're not normally speaking about grossly offensive behavior, although that can happen, of course, anywhere. But we are talking about less formal behavior, which may on some occasions be considered rude. Aristasian behavior is formal, as is the behavior of most traditional people. The basis of this formality is the recognition of the divine sun in each of us. So the greeting which we give Raiati, which means hail to the sun in you, is a recognition that the divine spark, the solar spirit, lies in the heart of each of us, the heart in the human being, the hearth in the house, the sun in the cosmos, is all the same thing. It is this burning center of reality. And we recognize this in each of us, and so we give honor to each other. And so we use respectful and honorific language, and so we have a formality which recognizes the high nature of life. In Telluria, as we were speaking of before, this is why the subjects that I'm discussing link together. Once you begin to see people as mere animals, then the importance, the seriousness of human life begins to be lost, and we no longer feel the need to give honor to each other or to be formal. And so society becomes increasingly informal as a result. Now, having said that, it is well known that in Aristasia the West is less formal than the East. So we need to ask ourselves, who uses informal behavior, to whom, and when, and why? Now, obviously, all over Aristasia, informal behavior is more appropriate among close friends and family. Now, perhaps one test of this is how we address each other. In Aristasia, we would normally address each other as a miss, or whatever the equivalent of miss is in our particular place, followed by a family name. So I would call Miss Vargas, Miss Desi Octavia Vargas, Miss Vargas. Now, the next level down from that formality is to call her by miss, followed by her given name, her personal name. In Telluria, the use of the personal name without any honorific is often becoming common, even between people who hardly know each other. This would be very surprising and rather shocking in Aristasia. We drop the honorific, the miss, or whatever it is, only in cases of very close relationship to one's children, of course. But the children do not do the same back to the parent. The mother would call her child Alice or Chrysothemis or whatever her name may be, but they don't call back their parents by the first name. That would be very, very wrong. And the term, not so much used in the West, but still used in part of the West and in the East, too. I'll spell that for you, because it's a word that you have in English. Too. You call it thou. I'm not sure why, because The other word you use is this one, you, and that's pronounced you. So this one in Aristeza is also pronounced tu. And that's akin to tu in French, to du in German. It is the singular of you, and it is the informal, the affectionate form. Yes, Ms. Vargas, you mentioned tu in Spanish. Yes, it's common in Europe. Now, although it is the singular, we do not address most people most of the time in the singular. We address them in the plural. That's right, in Italian too. And in the South, in America, in the Southern states, this is also remembered because the term y'all, often addressed to a single person. This is an honorific form. Because we have in English, in modern English, lost this singular, in places where there is still an instinct to use the honorific form, you will find people pluralizing the word you. So you get y'all in the Southern states of America, you get yous in Ireland, yous, which again is a pluralization of you, because there is this sense that addressing people in the singular is not really the right thing to do if they are not inferiors, or one's children, or one's wife, or some very close relation. The other time we use tu, which is interesting, is often in addressing dea, as in telluria. Thou, too, is used towards God, and that is because our relation with Dea is, or should be, the most intimate possible relation. So we talk about informality in the home, between relations and close friends, but even that requires some qualification, because especially in the East, the use of honorific terms can also be a sign of affection. In the West, there is to some extent, I'm talking here about Western Aristasia, there is to some extent a habit of dropping formality, especially among younger people of equal status. It's not universally approved of, it has to be used with caution. And it is something people will grow out of. They may do it when they're young, but they won't go on doing it. It's not that the younger generation is doing something and so in a generation things will change. It is not appropriate except to relatively young people, and many young people don't do it and don't find it acceptable. So there is in the West a certain ambiguity. One can be rude without meaning it. Western people going to the East can be rude without meaning to be rude at all. People from a certain group in the West, if they use the kind of informality that they are used to using among their own group, may find themselves very much disapproved of in another group. And the thing which is very interesting here is that even among a group which is very informal, one such group of which you all have some knowledge is the group of young people in the story The Princess and the Captain. This is a group of people who are mixed Navarian and Quirinal. They are teenagers. They are in fact an aristocratic motorcycle gang, essentially. They have kicked over the traces. The captain, Antelofia Marcia, is in fact a deserter from a military academy. So they behave in ways that are not what would be considered at all formal or proper. And yet even they, as you'll see, are rather more formal than many people in Western Telluria. But the other thing that is very interesting is that even among a group like that teenage, rather rebellious group, even when they are informal most of the time, they become formal when things are serious and when they are emotionally moved. If they are angry, they will suddenly become eloquent and formal. If they are in love, they will suddenly become formal. Now, this is a very interesting observation because G.K. Chesterton, the English writer, notes something very similar in England in the 1930s. He notes that even 30 years before his time, in the Victorian era, this was the case in Parliament, in the records of the English Parliament. When someone is moved, when someone is angry, they turn to flights of eloquence, to high speech, to formal speech. But even by the 1930s, the habit had begun in the English Parliament, and of course in many other places, the Parliament representing what was going on in the society as a whole, people began to talk in a more coarse way, in a more vulgar way, when they became angry or moved. So Mr. Chesterton gave the example of a parliamentary representative saying, "What's in it for us?" when some proposal is put forward. It's very crude, a very vulgar way of speaking. And the reason for this, and I'm sure you will all be familiar with this phenomenon in Western Tularia, is the idea that formality, that high speech, is artificial. And therefore, if one expresses anger or love or some other strong emotion in high speech, well, you can't really mean it. It must be artificial. It's not coming from the heart. But in Aristasia, in a traditional society, even in England in the 19th century, high speech is the guarantee of the genuineness of one's feeling. One speaks in a high language because the emotion is great and it can only be expressed by high words. And this is something that someone brought up in Western, modern Telluria really needs to understand about traditional people in general, but about Aristasians in particular, because that is what we are discussing here. They would become more formal as they become more moved. Even if informality is the usual mode of life, formality would quickly supervene when things are serious, when things are impassioned. And this tells us something else. It tells us that informal behavior is considered essentially unreal behavior. When things become real, we drop informality. Informality is joking about. It is not serious. It's not what you do when you really mean it. There are certain words used in the West and in the East for rude behavior or informal behavior. They are words, the ones I'm going to discuss here, are words which are actually avoiding the term rude, because to call someone rude is actually quite serious in Aristasia, rather more serious than it would be in Telluria. So we have this word ad lib. If somebody says something which is out of place, which is improper, someone might say, "Stop ad libbing." Now, this is a theatrical term, obviously, and what it implies is a deviation from the script, a deviation from ways of speaking and doing which are laid down, which are correct. And therefore, if you deviate, if you do something unexpected, you are ad-libbing. Another slightly nicer term, which is often used for a person, is that she is a grace note. A grace note. It's a term taken from music. And what it means here is she behaves in ways which are not those prescribed by the harmony of society, by the tame. So she does, it's like ad-libbing. And the implication here is very important. There is a main tune, and that is the thing that matters. The grace note may even be charming, but it isn't important. Now, another word which we should look at, which gives us an insight into what is going on here, is the word enormity. Enormity. Now, in the West, in Telluria, in recent times, the word enormous means very large. But if we think about the roots of this word, what it actually means is out of the ordinary. A norm. A means out, norm means the usual. So something enormous is something out of the ordinary. And in colloquial speech in Western Telluria, enormous has come to mean out of the ordinary in respect of largeness, of size. But the word enormity doesn't mean that. An enormity, even in Telluria, to people who know what their language means, well, as what I will do here is read from the Oxford Dictionary. Definition of enormity: 1. Deviation from the normal standard or type, especially from moral or legal rectitude. In later use, monstrous wickedness. The second definition: that which is abnormal, an irregularity, a crime. In later use, a monstrous offence. The third definition is excess in magnitude, that is, large size, and it notes that this is an incorrect use. An enormity is an outrage. Someone commits an enormity. In Aristasia, the word is used more, in fact, to mean rudeness. The way she spoke was enormous. Enormous. That is the word you'll find in Aristasia. You don't find it in Telluria. Somebody is very rude, you say, "This is an enormity. Stop speaking like this." And what do we mean by an enormity? We mean acting out of the usual, out of the expected, out of what is laid down as being proper to do. And underneath all these terms, ad-libbing, the grace note, enormous, lies the concept of tame. Tame. That should also have a umlaut over the top, but I'm afraid I didn't possess one. Tame is the harmony of human behavior. It is the harmony of cosmic behavior. It is the harmony to which we all belong. And tame lays down the rules of social behavior, which certainly in the East are very precise. Whatever you do, there is a precise way of doing it. There is a way of addressing each person according to her particular rank and type. There is an order of seating at a table, or even sitting around in chairs in a drawing room. There is a way of entering a room, of leaving a room, of entering a house, of leaving a house. There is a way of doing each thing. And this is a formality. This is tame. This is the harmony of being. In the West, this is somewhat weaker, but it is still very strongly there. Even though some of the rules are no longer followed, the idea that someone may step out of it, may become enormous, may ad-lib, maybe even rather charmingly, a grace note. Charming, but not too important, because the important things are the things that happen within the tame. Just as when we become impassioned, we feel that what we have to say is important, we drop any casual ways of speaking we have, and we revert to the former. So this is to give you an idea of what formality is in Aristasia, what it signifies, why it is abrogated, the ambiguities that lie in its abrogation, and why formality, order, harmony are regarded as the norm and as being of great importance as a foundation of the society and its ways. All right, I've gone on at rather considerable length about this. Has anybody now any questions they wish to ask? Now, as we are coming towards the end of my part of this, I should like to ask if anybody has any other questions. Anything at all, not simply what we have talked about today, but if you are maybe thinking of writing about Aristasian life, have points come up where you've thought, I wonder how that would be conducted. Miss Poppy, what was your question? Miss Poppy asks whether, in the reverence, a curtsy is considered as polite as a bow. The curtsy is rather a West phenomenon, not entirely Western, because in Eastern Arcadia it is also used. It is only used by blondes. You won't see a brunette curtsying. But in those areas where it is used, it would be considered as polite as a bow most of the time. In certain formal occasions, the bow would be de rigueur. It would be the thing that would be traditionally used. And there are also some traditional circumstances, some particular institutions or courts where the blondes would in fact curtsy, where that would be the expected thing. So it depends where you are. But yes, if you curtsy, it will be treated as a reverence, just the same as a bow. And as with a bow, it will vary from a little bob to a very deep curtsy, which is held for a longer length of time. This is the same with a bow, how polite it is. Depends largely on what kind of a bow it is. You have the sharp little military bow, which is just acknowledging someone. You have a much deeper bow also. You can have a deeper military bow too. But essentially how deep it is and how long it is held. And if the hands are placed together, where they're placed. If they're placed at the chest, it is a less formal bow than if they are placed at the forehead. But yes, the point is that a curtsy will be the same. It may be deeper, it may be held longer. Its degree of politeness is determined by that, rather than by the fact that it is a curtsy. Does that answer your question, Miss Poppy? Miss Chrysothemis, what did you wish to ask? Miss Chrysothemis asks, when Aristasians from different provinces... Miss Vargas, could you please give Miss Poppy and Miss Chrysothemis a large M? When Aristotelians from different provinces meet, is there much difficulty about different customs? Or do people know the other province's customs? Well, of course, this will depend. If you are going to another province, of course, it is good manners to try to learn their customs before you go there and to fit in with them. Obviously, there will be some acceptance of the fact that a foreigner in a given province may not know exactly how to behave in all respect, but the more important parts of a province's behavior a visitor really ought to know. She ought to make herself au fait with those out of politeness to the people she is visiting. The most difficulties come really when people from the west travel far into the east, and the ways of doing things then are often quite different, so they can feel very much at sea with them. That, I think, is where the most difficulty would lie. But of course, when dealing with someone very foreign, there would be even more leeway allowed. People will say, well, this person really doesn't know. I think where the difficulty would become most intense is when a Westerner has lived for a while in the East and has superficially picked up the culture and so appears to be au fait with it, but will then say or do something which is very much out of keeping. Now, it is to be hoped that she will learn as she goes along not to do that, but it can occur on occasion. Does that answer your question, Miss Chrysothemis? Are there any more questions? Signorina Clarissa, what was your question? Thank you very much, Signorina. Signorina Clarissa said that it's not a question, but she finds her reaction to the concept that formality is real behavior and not forced is very refreshing. I think that is very true. I think there is a lot of misunderstanding between people because they do not have a formality of behavior. For example, the question of apology. In Western Tularia, people find it difficult to give apologies, and they also find it difficult to receive apologies, because there is no straightforward procedure. In Aristasia, you will find that people apologize more often. If they've done some little thing wrong, or even something that could be considered wrong from a certain point of view, for example, if they have to leave for some reason, they may well apologize, they may well accuse themselves of rudeness, particularly in the East, but all over Aristasia this will happen. When an apology is given, it is given with a reverence, a deeper reverence than would normally be used to the person to whom one is apologizing. And it should be made humbly. And when it is made, the person who receives the apology accepts it gracefully. And then the thing that is wrong is put into the past and it is put right. Now, there are a few occasions perhaps when someone may continue to offend and the apology may seem a little shallow, but rejecting an apology is not something one does in Aristasia. There are other means of bringing someone to heel who is behaving badly. But in Deloria, these ritual means of clearing up problems don't exist, and so deep difficulties with people can become exacerbated, can get much worse, and there is no way of going about putting things right. Formal, almost rituals give us ways of doing things which everybody understands, everybody accepts, everybody knows on what level to take them and how to respond to them, and that is terribly important. Miss Niami, what was your question? Miss Vargas, could you give Signorina Clarissa a large M, please? Miss Niami asks about the four estates. Is it common that people change estates? No, it is not common. It can happen, but it is not very common. In fact, I think it says somewhere in the essay about estates that this is a question that Tularians will often ask. And that is because in Tularia we have this concept of individualism, that people will pursue their own course. In the East, as I was saying before, the hereditary principle works much better. If someone is born into a family with a particular calling, she will likely be suited to that calling. There are times when it is necessary to change estate, but those times are relatively rare. What has happened in the West is that the entire institution of estate has weakened. In Quirinal, or even in Trent, people are not bound by estate in the same way that they are in the East. And I suppose this is the equivalent to what happens in the Tellurian West of the greater individuality, the greater individualism. As I think we've said on other occasions, the higher estates, the Hayala and Rahira, in the West, tend to merge together into a kind of general upper class, the high midler, big business mates, they will also become part of this upper and upper middle class. So you have something a little bit more like the class structure in Telluria, but the similarity is deceptive because the estates still underlie quite a lot of people's thinking in the end. It's rather like even when people are informal, formality is underlying it all. It's what would be considered real. So even when people have almost forgotten their estate, ultimately a lot of one's behavior, a lot of what one is, derives from that estate. Because Aristotelians believe, I believe, that the estates are four fundamental types of person. They are related to the four elements. So what one is, one's estate, is going to affect the way one reacts to things, the way one behaves. It's a bit like, while people think of an estate as a very binding thing in Telluria, another thing one might liken it to almost is to signs of the zodiac. One is born under a certain sign, and one has certain characteristics because one is born under that sign, and the same with the estate into which one is born. Miss Vargas, I'll take your question now, and could you please give Miss Naomi a large M? Does that answer your question, Miss Naomi? Thank you. Miss Vargas, what were you going to ask? Well, that is a very interesting question. Miss Vargas asks if Aristotle has a caste like untouchables made up of incorrigible persons. No, not really. I know that the answer to this is there are very few incorrigible persons, very few. As you probably know, if people commit very serious offences, they will usually be put into bonded service, which means essentially that they take on the Paxia estate, whatever estate they originally came from. And usually they will settle into this estate in the case of really serious, really difficult offenders. They may never come out of this estate. There are a few cases where someone is, as you say, incorrigible, and then she will tend to be out of society altogether, perhaps to go off to some other place or something. She may travel from place to place, but it's not an estate, it's not an institution. She does not lose her estate, because her estate will be formally Paxia, presumably, because she would have been put into bonded service by this stage. There isn't any estate below that. What she does, if she really doesn't accept that, is that she has to leave, she has to go somewhere else, and then presumably wherever else she goes, she may not fit in, so she might become some sort of a vagabond. But this, as I say, is very rare, and it's not a common enough phenomenon that there would be any such estate or any such group of people. Occasionally, one or two criminal-type people might get together and form a band of two or three, but that would be the most that would ever happen. There is no permanent estate of untouchables, no. Please give yourself a large M. That was a very, very good question, actually. Very, very thoughtful. Thank you. Now, have we any further questions? Now, if we have no further questions, I shall turn off my microphone in a moment and leave you to converse among yourselves. If you have anything you want to ask me about anything at all, now is the time to do it. Maybe nothing to do with what we're talking about. Maybe if something you've been wondering about Aristotelia. Could you post them at the Blue Camellia Club, please, Miss Vargas? That is what Miss Drusilla normally does. She hasn't done it for last week, but I think she hasn't been very well. And they're not actually order marks, I should say. An order mark is a bad mark. You don't want to get order marks. I should like to thank you for acting on my suggestion last week and populating this room, the White Rose Room, much more during the week. It has worked very well. There have been a lot more meetings taking place at the White Rose Room. It has been much less deserted, and I should like to thank you, particularly Miss Madonna and Miss Poppy, who I think have been working on this especially. Miss Vargas, no, the order mark, what is called an order mark, is a bad mark. I mean, it could be called bad, but I suppose order is a slight euphemism, a mark that is used for keeping people in order. I'm very glad you've enjoyed it, Miss Poppy and Miss Vargas. I have very much enjoyed your company. You have been a very nice group. You have all asked very intelligent and worthwhile questions, every one of you. So I'm very pleased with that. And I shall look forward to seeing you again next week. Something I shall ask while you're here. Is this a good time for you? It is a time which is just about possible for all the time zones we're dealing with, which is why we use this time. But is there any time that any of you would consider better? Well, thank you very much, Miss Clarissa. That's very kind of you. It is, if we make it much earlier, it does become really quite early in the day for West Coast people. Not that early, actually, so it might be worth trying. But on the other hand, this will be right in the middle of their Sunday, so they may have trouble if they have anything else on to get here. We are planning to have a service for Rosa Monday on the 21st of June, the 9th of Rosia. You can see it on the calendar here. We will probably be doing this, I can't work out all the times, but it will probably be late at night in Europe, probably 3 or 4 in the morning, and during the evening in America. The reason for this is, of course, it is a working day, so not everybody will be able to come if we hold it earlier. So I'm sorry for this time in advance. That is probably when we'll hold the service, and it will probably be in the chapel at the embassy in Virtualia, but also here at the same time, so that you can also hear it. If you'd like to mark that date in your diaries, and I hope it's not going to be too inconvenient for some of you. Thank you very much for coming. It has been a very nice evening, and I have enjoyed your company and your very intelligent questions. I hope to see you all again next week. Rayati Rahiranya. I'm going to turn off my microphone now, and you may be free to be dismissed as a class and to talk among yourselves. Thank you very much. Good evening.